Good afternoon. Good afternoon. This is Scotty Reed broadcasting from behind these enemy lines. Today's date is February 17, 2015. You're tuned in to Black Talk Radio News with, of course, yours truly, Scotty Reed. We got an information-packed show planned for today. Have a couple of guests knowledgeable about the issues that they're working on or what they're writing about. And there's a lot in the news to talk about that's not really being talked about in the mainstream. And if they're talking about it, of course, they're putting their spin on it, their political spin on it. And some of the biggest news, and I would love to hear what Rush Limbaugh has to say about it, but one of the financiers of Fox propaganda racist news for you 24/7. Saudi prince or businessman, he's a businessman, but he got connections to the royal family or so-called royal family called the Saudis. And so he's been connected to the 9/11 alleged hijackers. You know, all of them presumably were supposed to be dead. But there has been news reported of some of these guys are still alive. But anyway, besides that, this guy has been implicated in the terrorist attacks or in funding Al-Qaeda is what the headlines were saying. So Rupert Murdoch's rich Saudi friend and Fox News investor, and Fox News is owned by News Corp, and that's what he is a shareholder in. And he's alleged to have financed Al-Qaeda and those accused of the 9/11 terrorist attack. So I got a clip on that, but I will play that later. But yeah, I'm not seeing this really well to Fox News credit, but we shouldn't say credit because they were caught red-handed. So they like in damage control now. But they put this out on their network. I guess they were forced to, you know. So anyway, that is a story that isn't getting the attention that it should get. Also, jury nullification. You got a U.S. attorney who is trying to stop a defense in this case called the Keating Falls Five. These were like marijuana medicinal patients, and I guess they were growing their own, and they're facing federal charges. And so I guess the defense is trying to put up a jury nullification defense, and he's arguing against this. For those that don't know what jury nullification is, that's when you get called on a jury and you tell them what you want to hear just to get on the jury. And if you are on the jury, then you vote not guilty on nonviolent so-called drug crimes. You're not going to help them to continue to enslave 2.3 million people, even more, that you are ripping off, taking their money from them through all of these schemes. And so, yeah, they don't want you to, they want you to uphold their unjust laws. And sadly, that is the case. That's how you get to 2.3 million people incarcerated and then millions more like on under house arrest and have these private people monitoring them. And that's costing millions of dollars to the taxpayers, and you just keep going along with it and then don't even care that once these people are put in prison that they are being forced to work for often less than a dollar an hour, working for major corporations, people that you and I do business with, because it is so prevalent. Like, you know, we were trying to find a cell phone company that doesn't use prison slave labor somehow, some fashion, some way in their business practices. And I mean, I came up with Cricket, but somebody told me Cricket was owned by Sprint. So I'm like, man, it's hard to even purchase services, let alone products that are not connected to modern day slavery and human trafficking. So definitely want to preach that jury nullification. You don't have to go along with the system and keep, you know, convicting these people and sending them to prison thinking that you're doing the country a great service, and all you're doing is contributing to 21st century slavery and human trafficking. I would indict you as an enslaver because you know these laws are unjust. Yeah. So today, we will be speaking to a couple of guests. We got Sister Afia Wangaza coming on. She is the first one to report to us, and we put it out through our networks that Venezuela had tabled the 13th Amendment, put it on the United States table through this UPR, process. Now, the UPR is part of the Universal Periodic Review, and it's part of the United Nations. And so Ms. Wangaza is going to explain that to us. Also, what they put on the table, Venezuela did, that is, on the United States, was telling them that, hey, you need to repeal the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution that allows for enslavement of people as punishment for crimes. And so she will explain to us what the United States response was to being told that your constitution allows for slavery. All right. So we're looking forward to speaking to her. And they also have a couple of upcoming events happening at what's the name of it again? The UN body, the Universal Periodic Review. Yeah, there's a couple of events coming up on the 20th. Looks like both of them are on the 20th. One is at 10 a.m. and the other is at 1 p.m. So she'll tell us about that. Then during the second hour, we will speak with Mr. Alex Newman, who was with us about weeks ago. Yeah, he was with us about a week or so ago, about 2 weeks ago. But we will talk to him about overthrowing Libya with lies, bombs, and terrorist proxies. I don't know if y'all heard the news, but allegedly you had some ISIL connected Al-Qaeda. I don't know. You know, we can ask the CIA and State Department since, you know, they helped create them all anyway. But, yeah, they've been connected to the beheading of 21 Egyptian citizens in Libya, and they were Coptic Christians and beheaded 21 of them. And so how did Libya get to this point? And what the mainstream media is skipping over is all the lies that was told primarily by Hillary Clinton. But she was the Secretary of State connected to the Obama administration. So, yeah, told lies, dropped bombs, and then used terrorist proxies. Those very people cutting off heads, that they all created that United States policy. Foreign policy created that. And, you know, there should be hearings on this, in my opinion, because this was the overthrow of a U.S. ally. And Libyan government was recognized as, you know, part of the U.N. They recognized that government. You can say what you want about Gaddafi, but he was legally in power. And, you know, the United States used these Islamic militants to overthrow that country, you know. But they had hearings on the ambassador being killed, died from smoke inhalation, but when the consulate was attacked in Benghazi, where he had been plotting and doing all his dirty deeds that ultimately resulted in his death. Let's just tell the truth about it. So, but that's not really being brought out. And Mr. Newman wrote about it. We linked to it. So definitely looking forward to speaking to him. And I do believe we do have our first hour guest on the line, Sister Afia Wangaza. Is that you?
That is me.
Oh, thank you for coming on to speak with us again. This isn't your first time on the network. And, of course, you know, we do Facebook. So, you know, just thank you for all the work that you've been doing through the Malcolm X grassroots movement. Been going to Geneva to testify on behalf of political prisoners. I think you also worked through the U.S. Human Rights Network, if I'm not mistaken.
We are the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination, which is a project of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, participates in the delegations that are formulated by the U.S. Human Rights Network, which is a coordinating center. And what it does is it assists non-governmental organizations in coalescing and obtaining training in accessing the mechanisms of the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. So we are have consistently been a part of the delegations that have been organized by the U.S. Human Rights Network, beginning first with the delegation for the Universal Periodic Review of the United States for the first time under the leadership of Ajamu Baraka, who was then the executive director of the U.S. Human Rights Network. And we proceeded with the campaign to put and keep U.S. political prisoners on the global human rights agenda ever since then. That began in 2010.
Yes. And so you were the first one to notify me. You even sent it to me in the email that Venezuela, through the periodic review, brought to the United States' attention, and I guess the world's attention, that the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution allows for the enslavement of people as punishment for crimes. So they call for not just a repeal of the exception clause, but a repeal of the entire 13th Amendment, based on what I could gather from the information that I found on their website, the UPR website. And has this never done before? Have the United States ever been put under review for the 13th Amendment before on an international level or in an international body like this?
Not that I've been able to discover. We know that at one point there was a question raised by Omari Obadeli, the founder of the Republic of New Africa, raising the question of the 13th Amendment as an imposition of citizen and a number of other U.S. Constitution amendments as an imposition of U.S. citizenship on Africans enslaved in the U.S., thus depriving us of the human right of self-determination. That is that we as captives ultimately had and still have the right to decide whether or not we want to be citizens of the United States or be returned to Africa, to the however we might be repatriated, determined that we should be repatriated, whether it's Liberia, Sierra Leone, or some region that is reflected in our DNA, or to have the third choice of establishing a nation, as in the case of the Republic of New Africa, here on the North American mainland in an area which the U.S. government lawfully holds as a result of lawful dealings with indigenous persons. Of course, that might be pretty difficult to find, but the Republic of New Africa, for instance, called for five states, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. The Ouachita Nation, of course, calls for an other sector, which it defines as the Ouachita Nation. So there are three options that African people have that we are generally not aware of and generally do not apply or even demand in our on our own behalf and in our interests. Slavery clause, the justification for the enslavement of persons, quote unquote, convicted of a crime, was a compromise clause that was written in for the purposes of doing exactly what it did, and does, which is to protect the interests of enslavers, primarily right. in the South, although all over the country. As the right. history becomes increasingly more clear, it becomes evident that Africans were not just enslaved in the South, but that we were enslaved all over this country. And
at least since 1865.
Well, we've been held in bondage in North America since 1619 with various mutations of that.
But what I'm saying is, in terms of what the United States recognizes, I mean, let me read the 13th Amendment, because this is what the masses falsely believe, but through, you know, the efforts of many to raise this point, and which is what Venezuela is doing here. This is what they are. Let me just read the text that's at issue here. This is the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. Section 2 is important because this brings in the federal drug laws. This is where they come into play in terms of modern day slavery. But Section 2 says Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. And the federal government to this date, you know, uses prison slave labor to make a number of products and things of that nature. So that's what Venezuela, you know, is basically just saying to the United States. Now, could you explain to myself and to the listeners of the process? I have linked to it. And so you have what's called, let me just pull it up right quick. And if you click on the link that I provided for you, if you pulled up today's program on the broadcast promo page for today, I'm at upr-info.org. So I put slavery in here, and so I did a search on that, and it came up a lot. I think I had to narrow it down to find Venezuela, and I think it's like near the bottom. Here it is, right here. It is repeal the amendment which allows for slavery as a punishment, and so they are under the category of the RS. What does that mean?
Reviewing state.
Okay.
The state that's being reviewed, which would be the United States.
No, I think Venezuela is placing them under that. And then you have the S-U-R, subject of review. I think that's what that means. I'm not sure.
I'm sorry. You're right. You're right. I'm not looking at the page that you're looking at. You're right.
And so they put two issues, Venezuela put both. There were two issues, points on slavery that Venezuela put the United States under review for. And I'm going to read it again. Repeal the amendment which allows for slavery as a punishment, and then prevent slavery of agriculture workers, in particular children and women. And the GEO group, which we have reported consistently on New Abolitionist Radio and our new program, The Abolitionist Daily, which, of course, will be coming on daily, will, you know, we just document the GEO group reliance on immigration, you know, being at a standstill. You know, they are lobbying against granting any kind of pathway to citizenship, because then that would mean that they will have to release, you know, I'm not sure of the numbers, but they're part of that 2.3 million people that's in prison in these private prisons, and they're being put to work too.
Well, yeah, and the work is compulsory in the prisons. But let me point out that when the function of the 13th Amendment brought into being the loitering laws, the curfew laws,
right.
voucher laws, immediately following Reconstruction. I would call attention to the book Slavery by Another Name, which traces at least a part of that that history as represented by the beginning of the industrialization of the South, starting in Birmingham, Alabama. That there's a PBS documentary, which I believe is available on YouTube or on the PBS website, that talks about the same kind of thing.
Yes, yeah,
we're talking
name.
About sharecropping, and we're talking about the convict leasing system, which was just another permutation of slavery. So we see that actually we have never wholly been emancipated, never. There have always been laws in place which have assured the exploitation of our labor for little or no compensation. And that is the crux and the essence of the slavery clause of the 13th Amendment.
Now, I guess the United States responded. And now I mentioned prevent slavery of agricultural workers, in particular children and women. And it says accept it, saying that what? The United States accepts that review. But then
what that means is that the United States agrees to take steps to prevent the agricultural enslavement. And that is that women and children, and indeed, although men are not specifically mentioned, but that all persons engaged in agricultural work would not be subject to servitude. Of course, then we get to the question of how is servitude or slavery defined? At best,
if you're paying them slave wages, I think you would consider those people to be slave. If you're paying them slave wages and you're coercing them in any manner through force, through intimidation, through terrorization, through any of that, you are engaged in slavery.
Well, that's our definition. The question is what is the legal definition by which the United States would then be bound? Because one of the problems with the United States' treatment of agricultural workers is that agricultural workers are excluded from the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the various standards that would be applied to the average or affected workers to whom the minimum wage applies, those standards do not hold for agricultural workers, domestic workers, some caretaker workers. There's a whole category of workers that are historically black and still people of color that have been excluded from the minimum wage, and they're referred to in human rights circles as excluded workers. So, again, in order to hold the United States accountable, there has to be a legal definition to which they're held. Now, there are certain standards that would apply that have more to do with decency and morality than with legality. But that would be the first step. Of course, as I said, the circumstances that you're describing are indeed a definition that we would apply and that we think people in good conscience would apply.
And in the UPR database, that is also placed under the category of rights of the child and women's rights. Now, the repeal the amendment, which allows for slavery as a punishment, that's the 13th Amendment, the United States responded with noted. And it was categorized under other. So what does that mean, noted?
What that means is that it is, in fact, noted that quote-unquote recommendation, which are actually criticisms and indications of treaty failures on the part of the United States as seen by its peers, that is other countries, but that it does not accept, but it, meaning the United States, does not accept it, the criticism, as a an obligation, and therefore feels no responsibility to either respond to it directly or to take steps to mediate the criticism or the circumstances that are described in the criticism. Now, that doesn't mean that the United States is off the hook. That criticism continues on the record, because what you're looking at is the official record of the United States' review at its first Universal Periodic Review. And whether it accepts the criticism or not, that criticism stands and can be reiterated at every review. And it's certainly one that non-governmental organizations or civil society, such as the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination, will repeatedly be raising to the United States generally, and more specifically, urging that it will adopt or accept that that criticism and begin to address it. And that is one of the benefits of participating in this process. One is that the failure, the treaty violation, is highlighted to the entire international community, number one. Number two, it gives to the citizenry, civil society, as well as members of the international community, a standard or a point of accountability to which the U.S. government must ultimately arise if it is to be in fully good standing in the world.
Now, the Universal Periodic Review, like you said, it's really not going to stop anything in the United States, but it is a point. It is as a matter of record, you know, as a matter of international law. But do you think that how does this benefit grassroots groups like the New Abolitionist Movement, those groups who consider themselves abolitionists, do recognize that slavery does exist in the United States and was never abolished by anyone, let alone President Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln. And this is just cruel. You know, it's a cruel lie that has been perpetrated for, what, 150 years. And every day people are being sentenced to slavery in American courts. And so is this criticism, even though the United States hasn't accepted, is what does that mean for grassroots group, and what kind of value, propaganda value? Does it have any legal value? Could you tell us about that?
I would say it's all of those things. Okay. First of all, it gives the grassroots, it gives any abolitionist the language, human rights language, with which to criticize the United States and to explain to the citizens of the United States, who are among the least informed in the world, and certainly the Western world, to inform the citizenry of precisely what the government is engaged in, the practices that the government is engaged in. Further, it allows for the abolitionist movement to confront the U.S. government on its effort to present itself as the global gold standard for human rights, and to challenge the effort, that mythology, and effort to impose its morality on the rest of the world. So it deprives it of that high-handed morality and moral play that it attempts to present itself. And thirdly, that it empowers and it encourages the abolitionist community to press its cause and its position because it has the support of the international community. Fourth, and maybe even most importantly, is the fact that the United States is desperately concerned about its image in the international court of public opinion. There are any number of various changes, including the civil rights legislation, the Voting Rights Act, the Public Accommodations Act, the Due School Desegregation clauses, and decisions, Supreme Court decisions, which is generally represented as being independent from politics, are all influenced by international public opinion. So the abolitionist community has that dagger hanging over the head of the United States should it choose to become more actively involved in the international community and to bring this issue with greater detail and greater vigor to the public public's attention, both here and abroad. I can think of no better next step for the abolitionist community to begin to, as we say in the human rights community, to name, blame, and shame the beneficiaries as well as the perpetrators of the prison forced labor camps all over this country. To begin to talk about the corporations that are actually involved in the enslavement of prisoners across the United States. It is an extraordinary opportunity for the abolitionist community to expand its reach and its impact and influence.
Again, we are speaking with Sister Ophia Wangaza, human rights activist. We need to take a short break, and when we come back on the other side, Ms. Wangaza, I want to ask you about Hillary Clinton. Now, she, of course, with her husband Bill, has run the Clinton Foundation, and indeed, even President Obama has spoken there as a keynote speaker and talking about human trafficking, slavery and human trafficking, but never in the context of what you just described that's going on in the United States. And now she is the presumed front runner for the Democratic Party as a presidential candidate for 2016, you know. And so I just want to get your thoughts on Hillary Clinton and her record, you know, on this issue, you know, of slavery and human trafficking in the United States. And so, and then we would also like you to tell us about these upcoming events that's happening on February the 20th, two different times involving the UPR. And yeah, we'll talk to you on the other side about all of that. You are listening to Black Talk Radio News with Scotty Reed, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. Stay tuned. We will be right back. You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
This is Tanya Free. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel plans to honor the Jackie Robinson West Little League players after they lost their national title over violations of geographic boundary rules. The players were stripped of the title they won last summer because team officials were found to have violated a rule setting geographic boundaries within which teams must find their players. What's your take? How do you feel about the decision of Little League International to strip the Jackie Robinson West team of its title?
The Tanya Free and Friends Talk Show, your destination for the best in social and political straight talk, Wednesdays at 2 p.m., streaming live on TanyaFree.com and BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com. Join the conversation Wednesday.
America's the land of the free, which is a lie, and the home of the brave, definitely a lie.
whole thing is built on lies. Invasions. Yeah, got my Quran in the semi. They say Lincoln freed the slaves, so they put him on a penny. Put the Mossberg to his back. If them planes hit Harlem, would we be in Iraq? New Orleans got stuck by the system. It ain't take 2 weeks to help tsunami victims. Damn, why they do us like that? Lie to us like that, man. Strike back.
And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News with Scotty Reed. And we have our guest on the line with us, Sister Ophia Wangaza. So what do you think, you know, about the Clinton Foundation's global initiative failing to recognize slavery going on right here in the United States? And she is the presumed, you know, Democratic nominee candidate for president in 2016.
Well, I think a combination of things. First of all, there's confusion about it, and it's a common confusion. When we change the words, we change what we call things, then there's a separation from the thing itself and the language that's used to describe the rose. But the saying a rose is a rose is a rose, if called by any other name, needs to be applied in this situation, especially when we start talking about the Clintons. When you talk about the Clintons in terms of the so-called drug war, where Bill Clinton helped to blow up the prison population with his omnibus crime bill and drug laws in particular. We see the foster care system blown up with the recommendations from Hillary Clinton about putting kids into foster care, and if they're not, their parents aren't straightened out, so-called, quote-unquote, within a year, then they can be, the parental rights are terminated and the kids can be adopted out. All of that is trafficking in people. Every single bit of it. The foster care program is a $3 billion plus industry where we have black kids being ripped away from their parents, their blood relatives, and placed with white families who make tremendous amounts of money off of housing them. Once kids are put into the foster care system, the likelihood of their not completing school, their being incarcerated, are all significantly increased. And all along that route, primarily white people are making money off of the bodies of black people.
You know what,
so
sister,
when we think about the Clintons, we have to think about the re-enslavement of African people using the legal system, or continuing to use the legal system in the under the rubric of crimes. That is human behavior that someone who benefits from it usually has characterized as unacceptable, whether it's two or three black kids standing on the corner, so therefore loitering, or we're talking about parents who have who are unable to make enough money to keep a roof over their child's head, being held as neglectful, therefore not being able to provide a quote-unquote safe and sanitary place for that child, providing grounds for the child to be taken and to be sold off to some group home or a white family. We see that same kind of thinking present in every other situation, whether you're talking about making baseballs in Haiti or you're talking about the NGO industry that exists in Haiti. Trafficking is not limited to sex importation of women for the sex trade. Trafficking in people ranges from the snatching of an infant in the hospital here in the United States from its mother on the theory that she was involved in some kind of drug activity and therefore is incompetent to have her child, to bringing in of migrant workers by the truckload to pick the vegetables that people in this country eat, and ultimately to have a basis on which to send them back, or to hold people in prisons in this country and force them to work with or without the minimal compensation that any of them may receive.
Right. These prisoners are doing jobs that, doing work for people like Sprint. I've worked for Sprint, but AT&T, doing customer service calls. So when you having a problem with your service through AT&T and you're talking to people in customer service, you may be talking to an enslaved person in there for 10 years, 20 years sentence, you mm-hmm. know, for some kind of drugs. Alleged drug activity, you know, nonviolent, hasn't harmed anyone else. And that's set up to 70%. I've heard from 70% to 80% of the prison population, nonviolent drug offenses, you know, not rapers, not robbers, not, you know, any of that, not terrorists, not, no, it's people, you know, who have been convicted through the system of some kind of, violating some law they just passed, just like the black codes, going back the same as loitering, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. criminalizing substances. They, you know,
exactly.
So it it's crazy.
And what we need to be, and two things. One is that when those people who have been sitting on those phones behind those bars providing customer service come home, they cannot get those very same
exactly.
jobs and make a respectable living and be able to reintegrate into our communities doing that same work.
Because,
that's number one. Number two, we as a community and people of decency and goodwill should be challenging those companies to demand that those workers, because that's what they are, those imprisoned workers are able to make the transition from employment behind the wall to that same employment on the street.
I say
to
that.
The extent, let me just say that, and to the extent that we fail to do that, we are complicit in the genocide that is being visited on our communities and on the persons of our brothers and sisters and sons, daughters, husbands and wives, on our people.
And would you say the 13th Amendment is the linchpin in their legalese and, you know, what the international community recognizes as law? So do you think the 13th Amendment is the primary cause of all of these problems, including what you brought up about the foster system? You know, I was just listening to Malcolm X autobiography that's played on the Context of White Supremacy's book reviews on Friday nights. And Malcolm was a victim of that. They took him from his mother and put him with some white people, and they were making money off of. So it is. And Malcolm recognized, in his autobiography, that this was slavery, you know, putting black kids in the hands of this white judge, you know what I'm saying? And that's slavery, a black man's children in the hands of this white judge. And this was what, back in the, what, 40s, 50s when this happened to him?
That was back in the 30s. But see, you can even go back further than that. You can go back to the actual Holocaust of enslavement,
right,
when kids were sold, the children were sold away from their parents. It's no different now. The fact that it was during the Holocaust of enslavement, it was in private hands. It was the enslaver whose option it was to sell a child away from his parents. Now it is the government, it is in public hands that sells a child away from his or her parents. That's the only difference between the phenomenon. And that's what we've got to begin to see. We've got to look at things phenomenologically. We've got to look at things as to what the outcome is. In both instances, the child is separated from his relative, his or her relative, placed in a hostile environment, and there are people outside of that community which benefits from that separation. The international definition of genocide talks about the destruction of a people by removing members of that community from the community. That would apply both to children and to persons as represented by the foster care and foster and adoptions, and also the imprisonment of members, as whether you're talking about juveniles or you're talking about adults. So across the board, we have that same phenomena of our people being trafficked, being sold. That's all trafficking is. Right. It's the selling. We need to stop talking about the slave trade and start talking about the transatlantic trafficking in Africans, because that's exactly what it was. We need to update our language.
Now, can you tell us about these events and the time that we have left with you that's coming up at the UPR, the Universal Periodic Review? Two different events happening, both on February 20th.
The two events that are happening on Friday, February 20th, are in preparation for a intense lobbying of governments in anticipation of the May 11th, 2015 governmental review of the United States in Geneva. On Friday, the first session, the morning session, is with members of what may wind up being the U.S. delegation, but certainly representatives from agencies that will be participating in the U.S. review by other governments. Those agencies include the Bureau of Prisons, HUD, Health and Human Services, Homeland Security, the Interior, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. There are usually 20 to 25 different agencies that are included in the review process. They have recently began bringing state representatives, so there may be a state attorney general who participates. There may also be a mayor. The last time there was the mayor of Birmingham who participated and fortunately spoke up quite strongly against COINTELPRO and affirmed our analysis of it and the manner in which it was used to destroy Black leadership and Black political activity. That occurs in the morning at the State Department, and I believe I sent you the email already that has the link for registration. Although the deadline has passed, they may acquiesce and accommodate, and I would urge abolitionists to join in and attempt to register and demand that and join me in demanding that the United States accept that clause regarding the 13th Amendment. The afternoon session is a session with government representatives, non-U.S. government representatives. That means that we will expect to see representatives from any number of governments that have been invited to participate. That may be Cuba, Venezuela again, Zimbabwe, Botswana, any number of governments which have embassies in Washington, D.C., that would come over to Howard University Law School to meet with governmental, non-governmental organizational representatives like the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement and the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination, wherein we will be attempting to consolidate the previous calls for the release of all U.S. political prisoners and to expand the demands that are made to include the formation of a truth and reconciliation vehicle to devise a mechanism for the release of all state and federal political prisoners and any related matters. That would include addressing the investigation and compensation of those killed, those persons killed. There are over 30 Black Panther Party members who were killed by local law enforcement under the COINTELPRO era. So that would be an expansion of the demands. We also want to expand the number of countries that are calling on the United States to address these issues. So the participation in these two events is very important leading up to what will then be the second intense lobbying of governmental or representatives in Geneva the week of March 16th. March 16th through the 20th, we will be meeting directly again with representatives of foreign governments, asking them to do the same thing, to stand with Cuba and Venezuela in its call for the release of all political prisoners and the formation of the TRC. I would point out, and the third would be for the acceptance of the slave involuntary servitude clause of the 13th Amendment, if not the entire 13th Amendment, which, as I said earlier, goes to the issue of self-determination, which is critical. It is an essential issue that we need to demand and to advance. On those three points, we would then have that the record strengthened and deepened as a result of participation of greater numbers of countries which can come from greater domestic participation. And I can assure you for another sector, another advocacy community to come into this process will deeply affect the United States government because they feel that the need to be able to control their image, to control the publicity, and to control the questions that are raised with them. So I called your attention to this option, and I do hope that you all will take advantage of it. I applaud you for educating the public in the first round about this option, and I urge you to become a member and participate in the process that advances and forces the United States to deal with these issues.
Where can people follow you on the web and your work?
The best place to follow me is probably the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination. I can be contacted directly at mxcentergvl@gmail.com. I can be contacted on Twitter at Isia Wangaza on Twitter. So, and we will be tweeting throughout this process to gain more and more participation. We are also desperately in need of financial support. We do not get any government funds. We get no funds from the U.S. Human Rights Network. And the only way that this work continues is by donations from the general public.
Well, it was good to speak with you. And, of course, we look forward to having you back to give us a report on what occurs on the 20th. That's just, what, 3 days away. So,
Good speaking with you. It'll be my pleasure.
All right. You have a great afternoon.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Goodbye. All right. That was Sister Ophia on Gaza. We're about to roll into the second hour in just about 5 minutes here, and we're going to continue to talk about Hillary Clinton as well as the Obama administration, because she was acting as the Secretary of State when she did her dirty deeds, played her role in the overthrow of the Libyan government. Muammar Gaddafi called for his assassination and then laughed like a little schoolgirl, you know, getting invited to a party. When she got confirmation that Gaddafi was dead. And these are international war crimes. And the Libyan government actually had standing as an ally of the U.S. government against the war on terror going back to 2005 in the treaty or agreement that was signed into law by George Bush in 2005. So there have been no congressional hearings about it. Very few people are even writing about it. And I would say in the alternative media, you know, when you unplug from the mainstream. So, but anyway, Alex Newman, he's been a guest on the program. This will be his second time on Black Talk Radio News. He has written about, you know, the lies that were told that got the American public. That's you. To buy into the overthrow of this government on humanitarian grounds. Now, you think about today, this report that we've heard over the past couple of days when it occurred, the 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians being beheaded on a Libyan beach. That wasn't happening under Gaddafi now, was it? So what did Hillary Clinton help unleash? Of course, we've been reporting on it, but we want to get Mr. Newman's perspective as a writer, as a political commentator on that issue. We're going to take a break, and then when we come back, we should be speaking to Mr. Alex Newman.
This is Brother Elliot, host of Time for an Awakening, and you're listening to Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennium.
See, that's, I mean, that's another thing. When you talk about a revolution, most people think violence without realizing that the real content of any kind of revolutionary thrust lies in the principles and the goals that you're striving for, not in the way you reach them. On the other hand, because of the way this society is organized, because of the violence that exists on the surface everywhere, you have to expect that there are going to be such explosions. You have to expect things like that as reactions. If you are a black person and live in the black community all your life and walk out on the street every day seeing white policemen surrounding you, when I was living in Los Angeles, for instance, long before the situation in L.A. ever occurred, I was constantly stopped. No, the police didn't know who I was, but I was a black woman, and I had a natural, and they, I suppose, thought that I might be a, quote, militant. And when you live under a situation like that constantly, and then you ask me, you know, whether I approve of violence, I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all.
See, America, in terms of where she goes and, you know, like, who she controls, the whole sphere of influence is diminishing. America is fighting on about 5 or 6 different fronts right now. Latin America, you know, like Africa, Middle East, and Vietnam, and here domestically. So I think that, you know, given the system and given that it operates off the military-industrial complex, which means that war is profitable, and that, you know, like General Steel, or USS Steel, must make steel for tanks to hire people, you know, to give people jobs so they can spend the money to buy other goods. The very fact that the system operates off that principle means that when the man comes back, when the man is run out of every country, then it will become necessary to wage war in his own country.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com. And welcome back. I do believe we have Mr. Newman, Mr. Alex Newman, writer, political analyst, commentator, joining us for the second time on Black Talk Radio News. Is that you, Mr. Newman?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks very much for having me, Mr. Reed.
All right. Thank you for joining us here today. I want to get right to the news, Alex. Of course, I know, you know, you keep up with, you know, geopolitical events that's happening all over the globe. And certainly you've heard the news about allegedly these 21 Coptic Egyptian Christians were beheaded by I don't know if it's Al-Qaeda. I don't know if it's the ISIL, you know, operating in Syria and Iraq. But, I mean, what do you think about that news? That happening in Libya? I don't think that would have happened under Muammar Gaddafi. But I brought you on, you know, to talk about how we got into all of this or come to these events today by way of, you know, people like Hillary Clinton of the Obama administration. But what were your initial thoughts when you heard the news, being that you had written about Libya, about these people being beheaded on this Libyan beach?
You know, first of all, you're absolutely right that this wouldn't have happened under Gaddafi. You know, Gaddafi was a monstrous dictator in every sense of the term, but, you know, like Saddam Hussein and some of these other dictators, they wouldn't tolerate attacks and violence against Christians. Actually, Gaddafi got an award from the Coptic Church for being a defender of the human rights of Christians in Libya. So, you know, he wasn't a nice guy, but, you know, the overthrow of him has led to just some absolute horrors across Libya. I've been, you know, kind of following the story since long before he was murdered. But, you know, it also speaks to a broader issue here, and I've written on this extensively as well. I did a cover story about it, on how U.S. foreign policy is resulting in the slaughter of Christians all over the world, in the Middle East, in Africa, and it's just a tragedy, and it wouldn't be happening without the U.S. government's interventionism, and I should say lawless interventionism, because none of these wars are declared by Congress, and so we're going to see a lot more of this. You know, ISIS and Al-Qaeda have been directly or indirectly supported by the U.S. government in recent years. And, you know, going back some decades, Al-Qaeda was, you know, very close to the U.S. government and, in fact, was actually kind of an arm of the U.S. government in Afghanistan. So, you know, it's just unbelievably tragic what's happening to my Christian brothers and, you know, all these innocent people across the Middle East and Africa as a direct result of U.S. foreign policy and the United Nations and the Obama administration.
Yeah, we have reached a point of disagreement, but we will agree to disagree and move on. But I don't think that Muammar Gaddafi was a monster. Was he a dictator? Well, in the technical sense of dictatorships, if you mean an autocratic, you know, supreme authority, but technically or legally, he was recognized as Libya's prime minister. But as I stated, Libya, at the time of his overthrow, was an ally of the United States government in the war on terror. And
that's right.
I think Muammar Gaddafi earns high marks if we want to talk about waging war on terrorism. He was the first to issue arrest warrant for Osama bin Laden for a couple of African embassies that have blown up, that were blown up. In the act of terrorism led to deaths of innocent Africans. And so, yeah, we'll move past that point of disagreement. But we do agree that the actions of the United States government was illegal in facilitating the murder, as you called it, of Gaddafi. So, but you wrote about Hillary Clinton's role as Secretary of State. Certainly, we had to bring in Susan Rice, what she was saying on the American news media to sell this, you know, humanitarian mission, as they were selling it, to get the American people's approval to attack Libya. And so tell us from your perspective, since you've been writing about it, you know, how did we get here, you know, today to where people are being beheaded on the beaches of Libya?
Yeah, you know, it's a long story, and, you know, really it starts, you know, since World War II.
We have about 40 minutes. We got about 45 minutes, so however long you want to stay with us, Alex.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Reed. Yeah, I mean, so I think one of the places where the United States really went wrong here is when we stopped, you know, following the Constitution. And the Constitution says Congress has the power to declare war. It doesn't give the president the power to declare war. It doesn't give the United Nations the power to declare war. It says Congress. And we haven't had an actual declared war since World War II. So I think that's one of the big problems right there, when you leave so much power in the hands of either the UN, which, you know, as far as I'm concerned, is just a dictator's club and it needs to be abolished, or the presidency. And, you know, Bush did this and Clinton did this, and going back, many presidents have done this, but it's inappropriate. And Obama even took it to the next level, because at least Bush, you know, when he wanted to invade Iraq based on lies, he went to Congress and sought an authorization for the use of military force. Obama didn't even do that. He went to the UN Security Council, presented patently phony evidence, and that's the most recent story I did about Libya. I mean, the lies are just literally crumbling all around them. So they presented this patently false information to the UN Security Council, and the UN Security Council purported to authorize military action against Libya. So, you know, right away from the very start, I knew it was based on lies. It was well known that it was based on lies. Now that's being confirmed even by the U.S. intelligence community, which, again, is the most recent article I wrote. A whole bunch of, you know, senior intelligence and military people have come out now and said, you know, it was a joke. It was a lie. Gaddafi wasn't planning any kind of genocide. He wasn't planning on massacring civilians. He was trying to put down a rebellion of actual terrorists. You know, the same people that the U.S. government claims it's been fighting for the last 15 years since, you know, the war on terror started, these were the people that had been trying to overthrow Gaddafi for a long time, and it had been plotting this. And then the Obama administration and the United Nations kind of did an about-face, and they switched sides in the war on terror. I'm hearing that used more and more, and I think it's an excellent brief summary of what happened here. We've supposedly been fighting Al-Qaeda and all these jihadists all over the world, but then in Libya, it totally flipped around.
You suddenly betrayed an ally, like I stated. They betrayed an ally since the Bush administration. So, yeah, I agree with the point that was made. Please continue.
Yeah, and so they did. I mean, they backed actual Al-Qaeda people. And I was reporting this, you know, many years ago in 2011, that this rebellion was led by actual Islamists and Al-Qaeda people, literal Al-Qaeda people. It's not just a figure of speech. Like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, to give you one example, was one of the leadership organizations in this rebellion that was backed by the U.S. government. And the U.S. military, as far back as 2007, identified this group, the LIGF, as an arm of Al-Qaeda, as Al-Qaeda's branch in Libya. So we were funneling weapons and intelligence and providing airstrikes and air cover on behalf of the same exact people who we've supposedly lost thousands of troops and billions and maybe trillions of dollars fighting in the war on terror for the 10 years before. So, I mean, it's not surprising what happened. And, you know, once the war got underway, we really started to see the horrifying face of all this. You know, one of the things that I found most ghastly about this was there was an entire town of black Africans living in Libya. The town was called Tawerga, and it was literally wiped off the map. I mean, it was ethnic cleansing. It was genocide. The Arab Islamists who wanted to overthrow Gaddafi, I mean, they viewed him as an apostate leader. And, you know, maybe he was an apostate according to Islam. I don't know. I'm not an Islamic theologian. But, you know, either way, these Islamist rebels, the Obama administration and the French government and the United Nations went out and literally wiped a town of black off the map. They executed them, they beheaded them, they tortured them, humiliated them, they tied their hands behind their back and forced them to eat living. And this was all based on these, silly lies Obama administration and other warmongering powers were spreading, that Gaddafi had somehow hired mercenaries from sub-Saharan Africa to come help him genocide civilians, which was patently ridiculous, and it was known to be patently ridiculous at the time. I mean, if I know it and I can report on it in 2011, certainly the U.S. government knew about it, and now we know that they knew about it. And so now, you know, we see what Libya has turned into today. It's a literal terror state. It has ISIS running all over the place. It has Al-Qaeda. There's rival governments battling it out. They took over the U.S. embassy, these Islamist terrorists, and were swimming in the U.S. embassy swimming pool in Tripoli. So, I mean, the country has descended into absolute barbarity and terrorism, and it's a total mess. And, I mean, you have to feel sorry for the, you know, thousands of innocent people who have been slaughtered as a result of this, you know, ridiculous and unconstitutional intervention in Libya that we know now is based on lies.
And why do you believe, Alex, that there hasn't been any hearings on this? There has only been hearings, and we might have talked about this the last time you were on the program briefly, but there have been hearings on just the attack on the consulate. You know, they resulted in Christopher's, what was his name, Stevens or Stevenson?
Yeah, Christopher Stevens, yeah.
Yeah, where he was killed. But they have not been bringing up any of the things that you just mentioned about the United States changing sides, betraying an ally, helping terrorists overthrow a country. We haven't heard any kind of hearings with those sort of tones on it at all. Could it be because, you know, that in the, across the island, the Republican Party, you certainly had, you know, those who helped sell this, and people, we could just say John McCain, for example. Hell, he went over there, flew over there and took pictures, you know, with some guys that have been identified as being part of this terrorist threat. So, I mean, why aren't we seeing, I guess if I'm going to, you know, boil it down to a question, in your opinion, why aren't we having Senate hearings, congressional hearings on these issues? They're very important.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head. The Republicans have blood all over their hands as well, not just in Libya, but Libya, you know, in particular. You had John McCain and Lindsey Graham, and, you know, conservatives call them rhinos, Republicans in name only. We like to, you know, pretend like they're not part of the Republican Party, but they are. And Republicans, you know, at the upper levels, the leadership of the Republican Party and the leadership of the Democrat Party, they're working for the same thing. I mean, you know, to just boil it down, you know, they're out for their own interests. They're building, you know, their dreams, their new world order and all these things, and we're not on their team. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, we almost live in a one-party state. You know, there are some good Republicans and there are some good Democrats, but at the upper levels, really, it's the same scam, and that's why we never see any change in policy when we go from president to president. You know, we had Bush, he was engaged in all this warmongering and infinite war and don't have to ask Congress for a declaration of war, and then Obama takes it and speeds it all up. So, you know, I think that's probably the biggest reason, is that there's blood on everybody's hands here. And the Republicans know that, you know, if they start holding hearings on all this kind of stuff, there's going to be a lot of dirty laundry being aired. You know, the same reason, why aren't we doing something about Fast and Furious? Why was Eric Holder sending, you know, advanced military weaponry to Mexican drug cartels and then lying about it under oath, and we don't do anything about it? I mean, we have some sham hearings, and, oh, okay, that's the end of it, and it just disappears, and the news covers it up.
I think that's why he's retiring, Alex, if I could just interject there. In my analysis, I believe that's why he's retiring, because his announcement came following a judge ruling that, you know, they couldn't keep documents secret. They had to turn them over, make them public through whatever the records request. And so I believe that's why he is retiring. So, you know, rather than face prosecution or go through further hearings or any charges, he's just going to retire, you know, and ride off into the sunset. But what about also the DEA, you know, under, what's her name, Miss Michelle Leonhardt, who runs the DEA? What about them cutting deals with the Sinaloa drug cartel, allowing them to, you know, smuggle tons of drugs into Chicago, that distributed out to other urban cities from Chicago? And, you know, two of the brothers who pled guilty to their role in it. Billions of dollars, tons of cocaine. We know probably guns involved as well for the Sinaloa drug cartel. They only got 14 years, and it went no higher. You know, what about Michelle Lienhart? She is the one who cut a deal to allow them, you know, this immunity, or we'll look the other way. If you feed us information on your rival drug cartels, you know, we'll allow you to do it. That's a crime. So, are anyone talking about that on, let's say, you know, the right side of the aisle, conservatives, libertarians, anybody talking about that? In addition to Fast and Furious?
I've been all over this cooperation between the U.S. government and the drug cartels for many years. You know, the DEA was busted at helping drug terrorists and the drug cartels launder money in the United States. We know they've been arming them. You know, a lot of this stuff was done under the supposed guise of investigation. You know, oh, we're investigating somebody, so we have to make nice with drug dealers and terrorists and so on. And then, you know, when you really scratch beneath the surface, you see that that's a hoax too. Like the Fast and Furious was really a perfect example of it, because they said, oh, we're, you know, we're trafficking the guns into Mexico to see where they would go and, you know, arrest, higher up people. And, you know, that turned out to be false as well. The two people that were supposedly being quote unquote investigated ended up being FBI assets who were described as untouchable. So, you know, why are you going to investigate an FBI asset who cannot be prosecuted, who cannot be touched? It doesn't make any sense. And, you know, I think we're really just scratching the surface here in terms of the U.S. government's involvement with both terrorism and drug trafficking.
Scratching the surface, indeed. I want to play this clip. Let me see what time is it. Okay, yeah, I want to play this clip. This is like, I've only seen glimpses of, you know, the truth about, or serious questions being asked about what has happened in Libya, whether or not it was legal to, you know, smart or, you know, against international law, U.S. law, constitution, all of that. You know, the only I think this might be like Rand Paul, who's himself been mentioned as a possible 2016 candidate, although I think people been trying to give it to Jeb Bush. But yeah, he gave a news interview. I believe it was on Fox. We're going to play a clip from that where he questions Hillary, you know, over what occurred there. And yeah, we're going to listen to that. And then I want to get, you know, your further analysis on Hillary Clinton. Should she be disqualified, or should she be facing any charges, criminal charges, for what occurred there? Certainly, you know, we had to ask the question of the Democratic Party. Do you really want to put a war criminal up as your 2016 nominee? You know, that, I mean, come on, these are logical questions that need to be asked. So let's roll this clip.
Because I asked people on Twitter to submit questions for you. N.H. Yank, he wants to know, how would you deal with violence here and abroad if you were elected president?
I think the biggest thing is, like, Hillary's war in Libya was a huge disaster. Not only are we more at risk from attacks from radical Islam because they toppled Gaddafi's government, we sent an awful message to Iran. Gaddafi gave up his nuclear weapons. We promised we wouldn't get rid of him, and then we did. So what kind of message does that send to Iran if they were to give up their nuclear weapons, which we want them to do? You wonder why they might be a little bit wary of that after they saw what happened to Gaddafi. So Hillary's war was a disaster in Libya. There are weapons everywhere, jihadists everywhere. But it was also a disaster on the international stage because it sent a terrible message to Iran.
On this video, yeah, that was where the jihadists murdering Gaddafi, and they're playing with his body right now. You can't see this. And, yeah, it's,
I mean,
it's
that barbaric. Is the land of unconfirmed.
Yes, we came, we saw, he died.
Did it have anything to do with your visit?
No, I'm sure it did.
I think that was Hillary Clinton making a Caesar reference. We came, you know, yeah. This woman is, in my opinion, a sociopath. Alex, what do you think about what Rand Paul said? I mean, he even, mentioned the fact that, hey, maybe Iran is, you might want to give them second thought or pause on whether or not, you know, they want to develop nuclear weapons or, you know, give up any of their rights.
Yeah, and it's absolutely true. I mean, we sent just a terrible message around the world with this unconstitutional war on Libya. We essentially said to our allies, hey, you can't trust us. We might turn against you at a moment's notice, and then have our, jihadist allies, Al-Qaeda, on the ground sodomize you and murder you. So, I mean, first of all, that's a terrible message to send to your allies. It's a terrible message to send to your enemies, right? We'll fight you for who knows how many years in Iraq and, exterminate the Christian population there. And then suddenly, we're going to like you a lot better, and we're going to send you weapons and give you air support to overthrow another government that we don't like. And, certainly Iran is paying attention here. And the whole world is paying attention here. This sent a number of extremely troubling signals, I think, to the world. And, the last little sound bit that you played there, Hillary Clinton's ghoulish cackling about, quoting a bastardized version of the Roman Emperor's quote. It's just frightening that we live in a world now where that is seen as something that's, even maybe not tolerable, but it happens and it's accepted. These people need to be on trial. They violated the Constitution. Hillary Clinton apparently specifically told Congress, there's nothing you can do to stop our war in Libya. The UN authorized it. So we've sent a number of very bad signals to the rest of the world, to oppressed populations around the world, to the people who are being massacred by, the Obama administration's allies in Libya, Al-Qaeda and ISIS and these others, same thing going on in Syria. Absolutely, absolutely horrifying. And, if I was a dictator, I would say, okay, well, then I guess I need nuclear weapons, and I guess, I can never trust the United States government. And that's exactly the message that they sent.
Loud and clear.
Mm-hmm.
People are listening. Now, I want to ask you about a unrelated story to the Clintons, but this is breaking news, and this is kind of unprecedented in terms of my Fox News watching or watchdogging, so to speak. But about this, what's his name? This businessman, this Saudi businessman being connected to Al-Qaeda. They reported on that last night, and I want to run that clip and get your thoughts on it, Alan, and also any other listeners that want to call in, even if you want to comment on something that Sister Ophelia Juan Gaza brought up about that report about Venezuela and the 13th Amendment, United States being put under view for the 13th Amendment legalizing slavery, or you want to talk about the current topics that we're discussing with Mr. Newman, you can call us at 530-881-1400. The access code is 549-032-pound. For those already on the line, just hit *6 on your phone keypad and then the number 1. Let me go ahead and run this clip. It's very interesting. And this is Fox News reporting about someone who owns News Corp, which News Corp owns Fox News.
A former operative for Al-Qaeda says prominent members of Saudi Arabia's royal family have been major donors to terrorist causes. Chief Washington correspondent James Rosen looks at the explosive allegations from one of 9/11's infamous figures.
In sworn statements at the Supermax prison where he's serving a life sentence for terrorism, Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker in the 9/11 plot, testified in October that Saudi Arabia's government, prior to 9/11, directly financed the operations of Al-Qaeda. A French native and Arabic speaker who studied finance in London, Moussaoui recalled building a database of Al-Qaeda donors. "I remember many of them," Moussaoui testified, "because some of them were known within the circle of the Mujahideen, some of them extremely famous, like Walid bin Talal, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, and Prince Bandar bin Sultan. Those three men are, respectively, a leading Saudi businessman and major investor in the parent company of this network, the Saudi intelligence minister at the time, and the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. at the time. The Saudi prince, you know, Abdullah Musawi, testified, referring to the future king whose 10-year reign ended with his death last month. He was a new prince at the time, you know. They'll give $2-3 million. Musawi also recalled hand-delivering letters from Osama bin Laden to those Saudi royals and to the man who is now King Salman.
I'm not inclined to believe the word of a convicted terrorist who was involved in the September 11th attacks. But Gretchen, there's one thing we do know, and that is that Saudi Arabia has been funding the schools, the Wahhabist fundamentalist schools, across the Islamic world.
Musawi's testimony was taken by lawyers for 9/11 families who are suing the Saudi government for damages. The Saudi embassy called Musawi deranged and noted his own attorneys argued he was incompetent, although the federal judge in Musawi's terrorism trial ruled him extremely intelligent. The embassy also quoted the 9/11 commission, which found, quote, no evidence that the Saudi government as an institution or senior Saudi officials individually funded al-Qaeda. But some U.S. officials who served on the 9/11 commission and on a joint House-Senate inquiry into 9/11 remained deeply suspicious of Riyadh. Former Senator Bob Graham, a veteran of the joint inquiry, said the kingdom is mistaken in its claim that the government of Saudi Arabia has been fully exonerated of any culpability for the events of September 11, 2001 by the 9/11 Commission or any other investigation. I am convinced, Graham added, that there was a direct line between at least some of the terrorists who carried out the September 11th attacks and the government of Saudi Arabia. And former Senator Bob Kerry of the 9/11 Commission said evidence relating to the plausible involvement of possible Saudi government agents in the September 11th attacks has never been fully pursued.
We continue to maintain strong counterterrorism cooperation with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Our mutual cooperation includes information sharing about shared threats from al-Qaeda and other violent extremist groups.
Musawi also detailed his life inside al-Qaeda, including the time when bin Laden's mother came to visit. Spending a week at his base in Afghanistan, she was greeted with a banquet and the festive firing of Russian machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades. Brett?
James, thank you.
All right, so that was Fox News reporting on one of its investors, among those include members of the Saudi royal family, but this billionaire Saudi businessman described as a great friend of Rupert Murdoch. They probably be having dinner at each other's houses and, you know, Skyping and all of that. But, I mean, wow, Alex, it seems to me like, you know, the Saudis was doing the same thing that we just got through talking about the United States government doing, working with terrorists, funding terrorists. I have read reports about Saudis providing that poison gas that was used in Syria, you know, financing that, also issuing threats to Russia about attacking their Winter Olympics. So, I mean, what do you think about, I mean, that's like a bombshell report, you know, Fox News reporting on one of his principal investors of his network, and these ties to 9/11, you know, we, like you mentioned earlier, you wouldn't overthrow Saddam, whether you agree with his style of government or not, what he was practicing, you know, he was not, you know, killing these, he did not have an involvement in 9/11, but we wouldn't, you know, we said that he did. So, but, you know, Saudi links, I think that has long been written about, you know, to the people who allegedly committed this act. But now we got Musawi and people want to act like, oh, he's crazy. Don't listen to him. But, yeah, look the other way. What are your thoughts, Alex?
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, there's no doubt that the Saudi government has been deeply involved with al-Qaeda, going all the way back to the beginning, actually. If you look at the origins of al-Qaeda, right, it comes from the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. There was, you know, the CIA and other U.S. government agencies in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and a number of other governments were financing and supporting literally the very worst elements of the opposition to the Soviet occupation there. Now, you know, I would say fighting Soviet occupation is a great thing, but there's a lot more than meets the eye going on here. And that's really was the genesis of al-Qaeda. I mean, that's where it came from. Osama bin Laden was involved with this. He was a Saudi. And, you know, there's no question that the Saudis were involved. And I think there's also no question that we still don't know the full truth about what happened on 9/11. Now, many of the 9/11 commission study group, whatever, when many of the members of that board have said the same thing. We didn't give all the information. We didn't get all the information. So there's a lot of questions that need to be asked there. Certainly, I think Saudi Arabia has had involvement with and continues to have involvement with jihadist terrorists. And, you know, this has been essentially admitted by Vice President Joe Biden and by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey. They've both said in recent months that a number of Arab, quote-unquote, anti-ISIS allies of Obama have been supporting and funding and arming ISIS. So, you know, this goes back decades, and it continues right up to the present day. Virtually all of the terrorism in the world today, if you trace it back, has its roots in governments, whether that be in Moscow. And, you know, a lot of the Islamic terrorism does have its roots in Moscow. And a lot of it has its roots in Washington, D.C., and a lot of it has its roots in Riyadh. And, you know, it's still going on. The U.S. government has even said some of these things, like the people were supposedly fighting in Afghanistan, the Taliban and various terrorist groups, are being openly supported by the government of Pakistan, like the Lashkar-e-Taiba organization that murdered 100 and something people in one attack in India. The senior U.S. officials have openly said in congressional testimony that this terrorist organization is being supported by the government of Pakistan. We're sending $5 billion a year to the government of Pakistan. What is going on here? If it wasn't for governments, there would be very little terrorism going on right now. Now, that's not to downplay Islamic extremism and so on. But, if we just look at the Christians, we get an interesting picture of what's going on there. In Iraq, there was millions of Christians during Saddam Hussein. They were protected. Some of them served in his regime. And now there's virtually none. They've essentially been cleansed, exterminated, and chased out of the country. A lot of them went to Syria. And now, you know, the powers that be have their little terrorist allies there, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, ISIS, etc. And they're exterminating the Christians in Syria. So this is going on all over the place. And, you know, contrary to the narrative that's being pushed by the media that these are just lone Islamic extremists motivated by Islamic extremism, there's much, much more to the picture that we're not being told.
I would certainly agree. Now we're getting, you know, so-called experts. There was an ABC News report. I'm going to see if I can quote the guy. Let me see. Chris Chivas, Associate Director of International Security and Defense Policy Center, and a Senior Political Scientist at the RAND Corporation. Yeah, that's what made me remember it. But he's saying, like, you know, it's a bad idea to go into Libya now, you know. But I was like, it's a bad idea to have, you know, attacked it in the first place and use these terrorist proxies. But, President Obama is seeking, you know, authorization, like, you know, Bush sought authorization to attack Iraq. He's seeking authorization now to do something about what's going on, you know, in several countries, Iraq, Syria, and, you know, Libya as well. And he's seeking that authorization, but I'm like, you know, this is a Hegelian dialect, a perfect example of it. You know, you created the problem. Now you coming to the people and saying you got the solution to the problem that you created. And it's just enough. And, you know, I think that this keeps happening. You mentioned a lot, decades. This has been going on from president to president, decades. How many of them ever get prosecuted for crimes? And so we have to look at Congress. We had to look at the judicial system as all being complicit in these crimes by not prosecuting anyone. I mean, they're prosecuting people, but I think the guy's name is Jeffrey Skilling, who told, you know, came forth as a whistleblower on the CIA torture program. And he's the only one that's facing prosecution, looking at 100 years, you know, for revealing this. So, that's on us as a people or people that want to say that we're a nation of laws and whatnot. Well, these people aren't being held accountable. And that's why it continues. You know, you can get prosecuted for having a dime bag of weed in your pocket, but, you know, go torture somebody in the name of, you know, foreign policy, and you're good to go. Your thoughts?
Yeah, exactly. It's grotesque, actually, how many war criminals and criminals of all varieties have gotten off scot-free the Obama administration, one of the first things they did was say, okay, we're not going to prosecute any of the Bush administration officials that approved the torture, that engaged in the torture. Just like you said, instead, they're going after the whistleblowers who are telling the people about this kind of stuff. So we live in bizarro world now where the criminals are, holding all the levers of power, and, the people who try to do something about it are the ones who are getting locked up and getting into big trouble. So, we absolutely need to do something about it. And now there's an interesting, movement going along with this. Now they're saying, well, let's prosecute them at the UN's court. And, I can think of few worse ideas than allowing the UN's kangaroo court to prosecute Americans, whether, it's Bush or Obama or anybody. They need to be prosecuted here. They need to be afforded constitutional protections. I know they're not big fans of juries. Obama thinks he can order drone assassinations of anyone he wants anywhere in the world. But they deserve due process. They should be prosecuted here with a proper jury of their peers. And, it's the only way we're going to put an end to this stuff. People need to be held accountable for the war crimes and for launching wars based on lies without constitutional authority. If nothing happens, if nobody gets held accountable, it's just going to continue going on. And they've terrified the whistleblowers now. People are so scared to speak out. People are so scared to share the information that they have because they think that they're going to be locked up, forever or for many years. The Obama administration is using the Espionage Act to prosecute whistleblowers who are telling the people this kind of information. I mean, it's just grotesque and really absurd. We need to get busy on this because, if they keep going with this, it's going to end, very, very badly for Americans and for the rest of the world here.
Oh, Alex, I want to take a short break, and then on the other side of the break, I want to shift gears for a minute, because the last time I spoke to you, we touched also briefly about jury nullification, and I got a jury nullification story I want to share with the listeners, and I want to get your thoughts on it as well. So are you good to go on time? Can you hang with us through the break?
Yep, absolutely.
All right. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News with Scotty Reed, broadcasting every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday, right here, part of the Black Talk Radio Network, 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. We're going to hear from one of our media partners, Tanya Free and Friends. They come on Wednesdays, 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern, right here on, again, the Black Talk Radio Network. We'll be right back.
This is Tanya Free. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel plans to honor the Jackie Robinson West Little League players after they lost their national title over violation of geographic boundary rules. The players were stripped of the title they won last summer because team officials were found to have violated a rule setting geographic boundaries within which teams must find their players. What's your take? How do you feel about the decision of Little League International to strip the Jackie Robinson West team of its title?
The Tanya Free and Friends Talk Show, your destination for the best in social and political straight talk, Wednesdays at 2 p.m., streaming live on TanyaFree.com and BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com. Join the conversation Wednesdays at 2 p.m.
This is Brother Elliot, host of Time for an Awakening, and you're listening to Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennium.
And welcome back. Once again, Black Talk Radio News. Today's day is February 17, 2015. Now, this story is about jury nullification, something that we preach on New Abolitionist Radio, which will be on air at 8 o'clock p.m. Wednesday night. But we have talked about this in terms of modern-day slavery and human trafficking under the 13th Amendment crime. Slavery as punishment for crime, corporations profit, most certainly the states and the federal government profits. And they use these laws like drug laws. It goes back decades, as Alex has said. It goes back decades. But there is a current case. It's called the Kettle Falls 5 case, which involves a family of medicinal marijuana patients who are facing federal drug charges. And the prosecutor is worried that the jury will ignore the law and vote to acquit the defendants in order to send a social message, according to a motion filed by U.S. attorneys on February 10th. So this happened about a week ago. what they're trying to do. Well, let me just read this portion. The motion also really doesn't want the defense or anyone else to talk about medical marijuana during court proceedings. Medical marijuana remains illegal under federal law, even though 23 states, including Washington, legitimize its use. Because the case is in a federal court, the defendants aren't allowed to discuss medical marijuana at all, giving the prosecution a straight shot at putting the family in jail for possibly 10 years each, where they can go and answer phone calls for Verizon, AT&T, breakdown products for Walmart, and participate in become slaves in the system. The Kettle Falls 5 case, this is in Washington State. Your thoughts on this in terms of citizens using this? And, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not even going to get into this motion that was filed. I don't think the defense is directly wanting to present a nullification case, so to speak, but apparently the prosecution is afraid of that. Alex, your thoughts?
You know, that sounds like a really interesting case. I hadn't heard about it before just now, but, there seems to be two nullifications at work here. The first one is the state of Washington saying, hey, we're going to nullify federal laws purporting to ban, medical marijuana and marijuana in general. And I think that's something that the states really need to start doing. And I don't recommend people smoke marijuana. I don't think it's a good thing. But I've been very encouraged to see states finally standing up and saying, hey, you know what, we're not going to obey these, you know, silly federal laws. There's no constitutional authority to make them in the first place. I mean, that's why we need a constitutional amendment to ban alcohol, because the government does not have the authority to ban or prohibit or regulate substances like that. And the second issue of the jury nullification, I think, is key, too. Going back to the very earliest, the founding of the United States, there's always been this concept that juries have the right to judge not just the facts in the case, but also the law. If the federal government passes some kind of law, say, directly violating somebody's rights, say they want to censor newspapers, or they want to restrict the right to keep and bear arms, or they want to, any right, then juries have an obligation to set their fellow citizens free, regardless of what the unconstitutional statute says. And the fact that the prosecutor in this case is trying to interfere with the jury's knowledge and ability to learn this knowledge, I think is a testament to how downward this nation has gone from its original roots. Nullification has always been with us in American history. Going back to the earliest founding fathers, the earliest president, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison both used state nullification against the Alien and Sedition Acts. They said, no, the federal government doesn't have the power to pass this kind of law, and so it's not going to be valid in this state. And then jury nullification, that goes even back before the founding of the United States when we established juries. Juries have always had the right, and this has been recognized by the Supreme Court and the federal courts and basically every credible legal theorist out there. Juries are not obliged to convict just because the federal government passed some unconstitutional law and is prosecuting somebody under it. And this would apply in cases like where the Obama administration is trying to persecute these whistleblowers under the Espionage Act. Juries should say, no, that's ridiculous. This man is not a spy. You don't have the authority to be prosecuting a whistleblower. We're going to set him free. And the same thing in this case. And the fact that the Department of Justice is worried about it, I think, is a good sign on one hand, but on the other hand, it's really worrying that we now have a government that is directly trying to mislead the jury about its authority and its power. I mean, juries are really absolutely crucial to liberty in the United States. I feel bad for people who live in countries without jury systems. They're really the ultimate check on government authority, because without the permission of your peers, without your peers saying, yes, this man is guilty and belongs in jail, the government cannot put you in jail. Now we're seeing open efforts to go around that. The Obama administration and Congress, actually, in this case, with the NDAA, they said, the military can detain people, including American citizens, indefinitely with no criminal charges, with no prosecution, with no access to a lawyer, with no access to a court. We're entering dangerous territory here. The jury is really the final check that we have on abuses by government. And the fact that they want to cover up the power of the jury and they want to mislead the jury, it almost sounds like jury tampering to me, which is a crime. Because they're not giving the jury all the facts that they need to make a decision in the case.
Great stuff. Alex, you got anything in works that you're working on right now? When can people get your next report and tell them how they can follow you on social media and read what you're writing about?
Yeah, well, thanks very much, Mr. Reed. I mean, my latest report I just cleared out today is about UN, they call them peacekeepers, but really they should be called war makers, abusing and brutalizing and raping children in Haiti. And, you know, I focused in on Haiti for this specific article, but it's going on all over the world. Any country under UN occupation is dealing with this kind of stuff. Haiti happens to be close to us, and it's just an absolute tragedy what's going on down there. People can find my work at thenewamerican.com or WNG.com. I've published in a lot of other magazines around the world, so if people Google my name, they can find it. On Twitter, I just started a Twitter account. I don't really know how to use it yet, but I'm learning. It's AlexNewman_JOU. And then I'm on Facebook and all those other things. So if people want to find me, they can get to me, and my email address is at the bottom of most of my articles, so people can contact me if they need to.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us today. We look forward to reading and, you know, analyzing your article and what you're writing about. And, you know, I do appreciate the service you provide and, you know, being blatant and honest about the truth, you know, in terms of especially foreign policy of what the government, U.S. government is doing, and many of its allies like Saudi Arabia. And, you know, not looking at it in a partisan issue because, like you said, you know, they're working for the same thing. It's really a one-party system. So, you know, that we can agree on. So, you know, we appreciate your work in those efforts.
Hey, well, thank you so much for having me, Mr. Reed. I appreciate your efforts as well. And until next time. Huh?
All right. Peace and blessings to you.
Bye-bye.
Okay. All right. Let's oh, my goodness. I think we got disconnected from the conference line, and we have some people dialed in there. Let me make sure I'm not.
This service is provided in high. Access code accepted. This conference is being recorded. Q&A session started.
All right. All right. Sorry about that. We got disconnected from the conference line for those that are tuned in over there. We're going to take a break, and then when we come back, we're going to get ready to wrap up the program. I do believe Tando Radio Show is coming on at 6 o'clock following us, so you want to stay tuned to that if you want to become aware of different markets in terms of investments, currency, different types of currency markets, precious metals, things of that nature, as well as they talk about health issues. It's a new show. They just recently started broadcasting, and so yeah, they should be on air. They're on air at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday, right here on Black Talk Radio Network. All right, so we're going to take a break, and then I will come back and see what else I can update you on. We don't have any comments or questions, so then we'll get ready to wrap it up. But I'm sure there is some upcoming things to report on. So we'll be right back.
Argument, and they go around talking about lawbreakers. We did not make the laws in this country. We are neither morally nor legally confined to those laws. Those laws that keep them up keep us down. You got to begin to understand that. For 400 years, she taught you white nationalism and you lapped it up. You taught it to your children. You had your children thinking that everything black was bad. Black cows don't give good milk. Black hens don't lay eggs. Black for funerals, white for weddings. That's white nationalism. Santa Claus. A white honky who slides down a black chimney and comes out white. We can't equate progress with concessions. We can no longer make that mistake. You see, when they gave us That nigga astronaut, you said we were making progress, but I told you they were going to lose him in space. He didn't get that far. You put Adam Clayton Powell in office and you couldn't keep him. What you think they're going to do with Thurgood Marshall when they get tired of him? They gave you Walter Washington of Washington, D.C., and you said we were making progress. That's not progress. See, it's no in-between. You're either free or you're a slave. There's no such thing as second-class citizenship. That's like telling me you can be a little bit pregnant.
Same way, they put their club upside your head and then turn around and accuse you of attacking them. Every case of police brutality against a Negro follows the same pattern. They attack you, bust you all upside your mouth, and then take you to court and charge you with assault. What kind of democracy is that? What kind of freedom is that? What kind of social or political system is it when a black man has no voice in court, has no nothing on his side other than what the white man chooses to give him? My brothers and sisters, we have to put a stop to this. And it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves. They attack the victim. And then the criminal who attacked the victim accuses the victim of attacking him. This is American justice. This is American democracy.
Obama and Black History Month, 2015. As the Obama administration winds down, what is its relationship to Black History Month, 2015? Of course, the election of an African-American was indeed an historic event, and history books will well record this fact. But it was also an attempt by the Democratic Party to lock in a constituency that would fuel its political ascendancy for generations. In symbol, the election of President Barack Obama was a shock to the system. In substance, it was a lot less so. For beside this symbol stood a reality that black life was under siege. In 2014, summer broke with black protests from coast to coast, led by youth, young people who knew in their heart of hearts that the White House could not protect them from a peculiar American practice of police terrorism. When cops could harass, intimidate, beat, choke, kick, stomp, and kill kids, boys, and men with perfect impunity. Symbol, shining and bright, met substance of blood and tears, and one shattered the other. Tens of thousands stormed the streets in over 200 cities to howl at injustice and to demand now, finally, justice. For them, Ferguson became their Selma, and they faced guns and automatic weapons with courage and fury. Symbols are powerful things, yes, but reality is more powerful still. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Oh,
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For live programming schedules, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com. All right, we are back. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News with Scotty Reed. I'm going to do a quick check of the program calendar. Today is Tuesday. Do not believe we have a guest scheduled for Thursday, but it's only Tuesday, so we may hear back from somebody. But we do have coming up on Friday during the second hour, Cleo Monago will be on to discuss Black Trauma-Based Mental Illness, or BTMI. So again, that will be Friday. That will be February 20th. Now, what's happening tonight, I do want to just give a update before we close out the airways there. You can find this information on Facebook at Political Prisoner Radio. Just put that in the Facebook search engine. All right. And in the notes section, there is a letter writing dinner for Jon Lehman and Tom Manning. Both were with the United Freedom Front during the 80s. This will occur at 7 o'clock p.m. sharp. That's tonight, a little over an hour. This is going to be for my Brooklyn folks up there in Brooklyn. It's going to be at the base, 1302 Myrtle Avenue. Again, that's Brooklyn, New York, 11221. You can find and download the directions if you find this note on Political Prisoner Radio. Again, it's the BK NY. Tuesday, February 17th, letter writing to Jon Lehman and Tom Manning. All right. And again, I will give out a little bit of information on them. Both are in prison for actions carried out by the United Freedom Front, the UFF, a clandestine revolutionary organization active in the United States in the early 1980s. The group targeted government institutions and major corporations that had ties to the South African apartheid system of racism and white supremacy, and the right-wing paramilitary groups that went on murderous rampages in Central America, also practicing racism and white supremacy through proxy racism, using non-white people to carry out their agenda and murder one another. But yeah, this also included taking actions directly against the South African and United States governments. The UFF carried out targeted bombings of corporate buildings, courthouses, and military facilities, as well as bank robberies to fund revolutionary projects. Both men were deeply involved in anti-South African apartheid organizing. All right. Fighting against 21st century slavery and human trafficking, and there are all his names, apartheid, Jim Crow, racism, white supremacy, yeah, against all of that. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's about it. Let me do a quick check. If you missed today's broadcast of The Abolitionist Daily, which is airing live Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern time, going strong for about 2 hours. Johanna Nelaya is the host of the New Abolitionist Daily. Their premiere broadcast was on President's Day. And go back to the archives and take a listen to Johanna and go in on George Washington and what a great humanitarian he was, so that we honor him with a federal holiday. You know, the banks close and you get to go home and, yeah, celebrate the birthday of this great man, George Washington. And, oh, by the way, he was an enslaver and much worse. Okay, yeah, go check that out in the archives of the Abolitionist Daily. You can get to them through the front page of blacktalkradionetwork.com. You'll see all the listings of the different broadcast streams and programs. All right, so we'll close it up. Again, I think that Thando Radio is due to come on air. I will be on air Wednesday night with New Abolitionist Radio with Max Parkes and Johanna Alaya for that weekly broadcast exposing 21st century human trafficking and slavery.